So the talk this evening is about fear. And obviously it's something that happens in our daily life. There are moments of fear. May even have had some today. And it's also a quality that both comes up in the spiritual life and also can be worked with in the spiritual life. So that's why it's my choice of a theme for this evening. And there's also something about this landscape, the spaciousness of this landscape and the wildness of this landscape that is hopefully both doesn't make such a subject feel irrelevant. Even though we're with a group of other people, if we imagine being here on our own, we can kind of have a sense of the vulnerability of a human life. And, you know, if we're really putting a lot of faith in other people to feed us while we're up here, if we start to lose that, then life becomes a very fragile and important thing and delicate thing. But also this kind of the space that we can open to the possibility that this is actually a really fragile existence. So, if we begin with, like, if we just get a sense of what it feels like to be afraid, what happens in our body, in our heart, in our mind. And it seems that there are many, many things that could kind of get us afraid. We could be having to do something that feels beyond our ability, like a very kind of physical thing, like needing to jump over a deep gap to get to the other side. And it can be, you know, exposing a vulnerability, telling someone you love them without really knowing how they're going to respond, can bring us into a state of fear. Or it could be a threat to our existence. Say, for example, we walk along and we see some bear shit, and while we're stopping and smelling it and looking at it, we suddenly hear some growling. That's the kind of moment where, what are you going to do? How are you going to respond? So there's those moments, like in the first example, where we're taking the initiative. Ah, we could turn back, not jump over that ravine, maybe go the other way. In the second one, life comes to you. Fear comes. Response is necessary. What are we going to do? And another is those kind of moments, usually in times of our life, when there's a night where we're sleeping and we wake up and then we suddenly realize this seems like it could all be meaningless or pointless, or why this? And that kind of existential fright, that dark night of the soul, comes upon us. Or, and all of those kind of bring up this feeling of fear. And it seems to me that there's quite a lot of similarities between those types of fear in the body, heart, mind response, the rushing mind, the beating heart, the shaking body, the adrenaline, maybe nausea. And yet all of those examples are quite different and really demand quite different responses from us. And the analogy that kind of comes to mind is like being a mechanic who has many, many tools for dealing with delicate little things and different situations. But fear comes across just like the only thing you can have is a hammer. Like, it's almost useless to be fixing these delicate things. So it feels like we really have to find ways of relating to fear, not trying to get away from fear, but relating to fear, the fear response, in a way that gives us the freedom to be skillful. Skillful with the whole full array of tools that we can have. And so there's this nature of the fear that also causes a real short-sightedness and excessive focus on the threat, on what we don't want. And in that way, it shares some relationship to worry. You know, there's a saying that worry is using your imagination to create a future that you don't want, which seems like a really funny thing to do, but we tend to do that. We tend to worry about the future. We tend to dwell on things that could go wrong. And so when we're experiencing fear, we don't want to either overestimate the threat and overreact, or underestimate ourselves. So it's really about finding that skillful way, but also not mistaking risk of harm, genuine risk of harm, for fear. One time, Krishnamurti, who's quite famous for writing books about freedom from fear and things like this, a great Indian teacher of the last century, he was giving a talk one time, and someone who was in the kind of upper balcony of where this talk was shouted down to him, you know, we need fear in our lives because it's fear that stops us from doing stupid things like jumping off this balcony. And he was a funny little man. Krishnamurti would sit on a wooden chair and speak with much more of an English accent than anyone in England speaks anymore, and says, "No, sir, it is not fear that stops you from jumping from that balcony. It is good sense." And so there really is this, you know, big difference of, like, you know, when there's a bear growling behind, you know, then you follow the sensible protocol. You don't think, well, I'm going to watch the fear and it's just a bear. It's a growling. Watch the sensation. And yet we do want to find ways in many of the kind of fear experiences when there's not that immediate threat that we can actually switch from short-sightedness to a real kind of breadth of vision, a real spacious landscape like we have here. If we can kind of look at our life with that kind of perspective. And one of the skills that meditation offers is that there's kind of two amazing directions that you can go in life. It's actually a parallel between something that science is kind of discovering about, has discovered for at least half a century, maybe a lot longer, that if you dive in to the physical world, if you dive in and in and in, you end up finding loads of space. You know, inside the nucleus, inside the atom, you know, it's like there's just a little speck of dust swirling within an auditorium-sized thing. That's the, you know, that's what's happening on this subatomic level. And of course, if we kind of zoom out and out and out, this human life happening on this enormous planet is actually happening within a huge solar system. And that solar system is happening within a huge galaxy. And that galaxy is happening within a huge universe. And God knows, nobody's managed to get outside of that. What's happening there, you know, if it's maybe not a universe, it could just be huge. And between every thing, significant thing, there's tons of space, tons and tons of space. And so fear is this getting locked somewhere between the telescope, you know, the microscopic zooming in down and realizing, wow, there's so much space within this experience. Or the kind of zooming out and realizing, wow, there's loads of perspective that has space, even in this moment. I'm taking this little one out of 7 billion human really seriously right now. I'm really, really saying that this matters, life and death. And, you know, it matters, but maybe it's not life and death. So it's a kind of way we have to just really ask that question when that sense of fear comes with that sense of urgency. It's like, you know, could I just take 5 breaths right now and then deal with this situation? And if I can take 5 breaths, maybe 6, and just slowly, slowly process this experience. Because if we do rush into something, if we're really just relying on a quick thinking response, sure, it can work sometimes, and then we can appreciate the miracle. But it is a miracle that it works. Slow thinking is more efficient, more effective. Slower moving. And so I mentioned early on that this kind of is a very common bodily heart and mind response to fear in different things. And so a really beautiful outcome of that, of course, is that also working with one type of fear, working with, you know, the fear of whatever it might be, we might be afraid of tall buildings or spiders or something like this, that's also building up that capacity to face fear, to be with fear. And it's a kind of a transferable skill into social environments, into various other things. So that, you know, those commonly held fears become easier to deal with. And then later, if we venture into the what we might call the kind of the groundless teachings of spirituality, which is kind of what this is all pointing towards, then that really kind of serves us well as well. When we start to kind of question if this idea I have of myself is quite as real a thing as I'm telling myself it is. There's a kind of a moment, a transitional moment, where that becomes a very shaky experience for many of us. And being able to kind of enter into that and enter into it in a way which allows the loveliness of it to come through really means that kind of staying with the difficult, staying with the fearful, staying with the, you could say, the unsteadying. Everything becomes very unsteady and ungrounded and what to trust on. One teacher described it very beautifully. I think it was Jack Kornfield. He said that a certain point in your practice, you touch into this kind of groundlessness and you realize you've jumped out of the aeroplane and you didn't bring your parachute. And oh my God. And then you realize there's actually no ground. So what happens then? Another beautiful quote about this kind of way that what fear really kind of shakes up in us is this realization that we can't take a firm stand in the world. We can't find a real security in the world. And Helen Keller has this beautiful quote that security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature. Nor do the children of men as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. And so on this kind of spiritual adventure, it's really an easing into that total adventure way of living. Not in a way of making unnecessary risks, but being willing to make risks all the same. You know, being willing to make sensible risks. To explore. To go deeply. In some traditions, they speak of the spiritual practitioner, the yogi, or the meditator, as a spiritual warrior. And of course, that's quite different than a violent warrior who's going to use force to overcome their foe. It's one who approaches their inner world with that warrior spirit. You know, comes in ready, comes in awake. And is ready to give everything. And so the spiritual warrior's path does not, it doesn't have time to wait for fear to go away so that it can have its blissful experience. It actually begins to practice in the fear itself, to find the space within the fear itself. And so the spiritual warrior's path is actually footsteps into fear, not away from fear, not seeking a blissful experience, but just meeting it and going into it. So responding, and even when the defenses are going up, responding to that, not reacting to that. So even though the self itself is empty, what's referred to as there not being a self in the way that we imagine it to be, it's also not a path of self-annihilation. So you can't just try and say, ah, this self doesn't exist, it's a fabrication, I'm just going to break through it. It's this really gentle taking step at a time into it and opening to the possibilities of, well, what is it? What is it? Because there's something here. There's something here. And so it's always important not to let our imagination of the goal of the path get in the way of how we walk the path. So keeping that kind of open mind about where we're heading to, just enough idea of where we're going to keep us moving, to keep us interested. But in a certain way, it's rather than it being an annihilation of the self, it's actually a widening into life, a widening and widening of what is possible, and widening of who we are, with less and less identification with the small, and more identification with the great, the love, the freedom. And so if our journey is one of kind of moving towards a sublime, blissful, easeful existence with all things, what would be an appropriate way of getting there? Probably it means that we're going to have to be willing to have our buttons pushed by other people and stay steady, to meet the limitations of who and what we think we are, and keep going. And in the kind of peace and tranquility and support and community of a moment like this, we can hear something like, everything is empty. Everything is flowing. Just let go. Just be. Just relax. But sometimes in that very moment where we can feel ourselves easing out from self identification into something larger and beautiful, really beautiful. It also becomes a time where we look to hold on to anything that's going to give me that continued sense of who I am. It's really where the kind of, as the ego is actually, you could say, challenged in terms of its role in our life, it really turns itself up to 11 and shouts and screams and makes a big fuss. And to quote Pema Chodron again, in her tradition, this transitional state is actually referred to as heightened neurosis, which sounds like something you'd sign up for. Neurosis. So I expect she calls her courses trainings in heightened neurosis and charges quite a lot of money for it. And so as we kind of ease into life, it also, stuff is coming up in a way of, you know, if you personify the ego is kind of wanting to stay in charge, wanting to stay in the center. And in a way, can we see that all of this, even this, is also a fabrication, is also just a coming together of phenomena to create a particular story? So just as we're watching the TV this evening with this delightful show, it's also just a fabrication. These words are just creating a feeling in you and a sense of something. All just a fabrication. Eventually it will pass. Creating it within your own minds sounds like a hypnosis tape. You are in Lapland. There are mosquitoes around you. There is a stream going by. You're in a safe place. So just being aware of what we do with this fabrication. Are we going to use this fabrication to say, yes, no, I'm not worthy. Oh yeah, put myself down. Or are we going to use it just as, this too is now the subject of my meditation. This too is in that space. It has to be in that space. And it has to be a fabrication. Because we're easing into this truth of the reality of things.
Is there another word for fabrication? Very much used word, I think.
Okay. So what it's implying is that because of, like, things appear to have their own nature. What would be a good example? Like a mosquito. They appear to have an unpleasantness to their bite. But if somebody says that they enjoy the feeling of a mosquito biting them, then they're revealing the possibility, and someone has said it recently, that the mosquitoes are unpleasant is like is one type of fabrication. So in that relationship, mosquito bites are unpleasant becomes it can't be separated from the relationship to it. And that's something that actually continues in varying levels of our experience. So it's also true in the way that emotions and thoughts and perception are also dependent on there being a separate perceiver to the reality that is being perceived. So this is some pretty deep stuff in a certain way that is maybe not making it any clearer for you. But another version that many people use when exploring the fabrication of the self is also if we take a car and we take the wheels off the car and then we take the axle off the car and we take the bottom of the car and we take the doors off and we put them all in a pile, then do we have a car there or just a pile of things? So the car existence is a fabrication, and so the self, as we take the self apart with the thoughts, the emotions, and that sense that you have of yourself, in that sense, is a fabrication. But maybe that would take a whole other talk to really get to the bottom of. But if you can have a sense of that, that it's something that's coming together, and as our mind comes together on the particular, we take it as real. We believe our thoughts. We feel that this is my emotion.
Maybe just one way of explaining fabrication is it is our the tendency of our mind to take various things and put them together into a kind of a seemingly solid thing. So that's how I would explain that word, that term. Mm-hmm. If that makes any more sense.
And the important point of it is that it goes from the very everyday right down to the very root of our sense of who we are and our sense of what reality is. And even though it can work on many, many levels, it's also really important, and particularly in working with fear, is that we don't actually use the fact that on different spiritual depths, different experiences are experienced differently as a way of escaping from working with what's on any one level. So as we're having a fear with one particular part of our life, we could use something which is sometimes referred to as spiritual materialism, which is kind of like, well, I'm actually no longer experiencing that because I can access a different state. And so we can actually move away from things that really need some attention by choosing to kind of turn a spiritual blind eye to some of the areas of our life. And so that's not spiritual warrior nature. That's not approaching and investigating and moving through the terrain. It's kind of taking a detour around something. And a little bit like taking a detour around an alligator. They usually come and bite you on the bottom later. So I just wanted to also add a few things about just a really couple of really useful tools, and one useful tool in particular in terms of meeting difficult and particularly fearful practices is a practice that the Buddha offered for the monks and nuns who were practicing under his guidance, often in very wild places, often with some real kind of genuine threats to their existence, but also for dealing with any kind of fears that came up in the meditations themselves. And this practice is referred to as metta, and it's one of the four divine abodes of spiritual practice. So it's both somewhere you can, something that naturally is a fruit of practice. It's like an unconditional friendliness or a very lovely kindness, which is something that we can practice. It's got its own formal practice that uses phrases such as may you be happy, may you be safe, may you be well, and also to oneself, may I be happy, may I be safe, may I be well. And this is a really amazing practice which most people need to incorporate into their practice at some time for kind of continued progress. And that's because it actually brings up a nourishing upwelling of well-being in the body and mind and heart. So just as when we're going on a long journey, we really need good nutrients and good sustenance. So this practice actually becomes a way of generating that mana, or you know, whatever is that kind of great nourishing food for you. And so for some people it might seem a little bit of a little bit airy-fairy, a little bit light and improbable, that just by kind of making phrases and saying things and wishing for things, that it would actually create a different world. And some people say, you know, well, you shouldn't treat the practice like that, you shouldn't expect results from doing it. And yet, it does radically transform people's experience. So, if you want to get good at something, keep doing it. Which is to say, if you want to be a loving, kind person, fill your mind and heart with loving, kind thoughts. If you want to be unpleasant, selfish, and self-centered, then fill your mind with thoughts about yourself and what you can get. And, you know, that's the kind of world you will create. It's not it's probably no surprise that that's the way the world works. Which is not to say that we only create our reality. Of course, other people partake in creating our reality. But we do participate in creating our reality. And in that way, metta participates in creating a loving and kind environment within ourselves, which can lead to a loving and kind environment radiating out from us. And that really helps with difficult times in practice, and also difficult times in social engagements. There's a story of Ram Dass, who's a very awakened and also highly intelligent man, has a PhD and was interested in spirituality and also LSD. And I think in this particular story, he's on LSD, but he's come back to his parents' home and they're having a family dinner. And he says that and this is kind of an example of metta in action, even though it's an LSD story, it could be on any kind of plane of seeing reality differently. And his brother's there, sitting across the table from him. And he's come back from India, and he was already reasonably old when he went and had like a balding hair. So he only had hair around the sides, but he let it grow really long and he had a big beard. And his brother was kind of teasing him and saying, you know, kind of teasing brother, like comments like, I see you've lost all the hair from the top of your head and stuck it on your chin, you know. And then he would see this comment come across like an arrow, you know, as it had that little bit of sharp intent, you know, see the arrow come at him. And then he would see the arrow stop and just float in front of him. And it's that moment of choice that something like metta can kind of give by slowing you down. And he would just take the arrow and put it down. And the normal response in those circumstances, he would say, it's like he would throw back another comment. And then it would go back and forth and they would friendlily attack each other. But instead he said, it's so wonderful to see you. I'm so glad that you and your wife are looking so well. I've really missed you. And his brother kind of just froze and then went back to the default and threw another another of his kind of barbed comments at him, like, and saying, you know, something like, you can imagine. And then again, he just noticed this arrow come across. But again, the choice, just put it down and then say something else beautiful. And then he said, by the end of that dinner, the family were closer than he could ever remember in the whole, you know, life cycle of this family. People were physically closer, conversations were deeper and more meaningful. So it's just another kind of example of where we can transform situations. And we know that certain words, certain moods radiate. You know, as we sat in the circle down there and people were sharing, we could really enter into and feel into and empathize with people in their moods and feelings. And so metta is a mood, is a feeling that we can radiate and generate situations differently. So just as a piece of music can kind of move us, change us, we can also do this kind of a practice and it has a certain ambience, it has a certain resonance that we can tune into. And if we find it helpful, it can really make a change. It can help us to open our heart and it can actually be a part of what helps us transform the world. You know, part of what brings us to meditation is finding the world a hard and harsh place. And by having a practice which offers something back out into the world can have real value and meaning. And not just around the family table, but really in larger actions as well. So hopefully this practice, in all of its forms, in the forms of metta, in the forms of kind attention, is actually allowing us to acknowledge, accept, and let go of everything that we experience. And if we can let go of everything that we experience, then that which remains, why is it remaining? If we're letting it go and it's remaining and it's beautiful and it's natural and it's lovely, what does that suggest about our true nature? If we let it go and something is remaining, if we keep on practicing in this way, then the practice of kindness and patience starts to allow kindness and patience to take the fall. And less we feel that need to hold on to the unhelpful parts of ourselves that keep life at a distance. And the reaction of fear becomes the response of care. And those parts of ourselves that perhaps even those parts that we've absolutely cherished can be allowed to kind of blossom and live for the benefit of everyone and everything. Because we're not in any way really separate from anyone or anything. We're a part of everything. And there is the possibility to live that way if we're willing to dedicate ourselves to practicing for it. So let's have a few kind, quiet moments to close. May all beings relax into their true nature and know deep down that there is nothing to fear, not even fear itself. So, thank you for your listening. Should we have a 5-minute break and then a short meditation together?